experience. He's able to withdraw $80,000 a year, 33% more, and his money lasts until he's 88. Hopefully, Joe lets David live in his basement for free. Now do you understand why you need to pay such close attention to the fees you're being charged? This one crucial factor might make all the difference between poverty and comfort, misery and joy. Overpaying for underperformance, the five-star trap. Here's a question you probably never thought to ask. How do you find an active fund manager who will not only charge you those outrageous fees, but also provide you with mediocre returns in exchange? Don't worry, the financial services industry has you covered. If there's one thing in plentiful supply, it's active managers who will overcharge you for underperformance. That's the incredible thing. It's not just that actively managed funds are overcharging their customers. It's that their long-term performance is appalling. It's like a double insult. Imagine that you just bought that cafe latte for $249, took a sip, and discovered that the milk had gone bad. One of the most shocking studies I've seen on this topic of mutual fund performance was by an industry expert named Robert Arnott, the founder of Research Affiliates. He studied all 203 actively managed mutual funds with at least $100 million in assets, tracking their returns for the 15 years from 1984 through 1998. And do you know what he found? Only 8 of these 203 funds actually beat the S&P 500 index. That's less than 4%. To put it another way, 96% of these actively managed funds failed to add any value at all over 15 years. If you insist on buying an actively managed fund, what you're really betting on is your ability to pick one of the 4% that outperformed the market. This reminds me of a gambling analogy that appeared in a Fast Company magazine article entitled The Myth of Mutual Funds. Its authors, Chip and Dan Heath, highlight the absurdity of expecting to pick a fund from that 4% group. By comparison, if you get dealt two face cards in blackjack, each face card is worth 10, so now your total is 20, and your inner idiot shouts, "Hit me," you have about an 8% chance of winning. I don't know about you, but I prefer not to let my inner idiot run the show. So why would I bet on my ability to identify the tiny minority of fund managers who outperform over many years? You might be a hardcore researcher who loves to read the Wall Street Journal and Morningstar, searching for the illustrious five-star fund, the outperformer. But there's another problem that few anticipate. Today's winners are almost always tomorrow's losers. The Wall Street Journal wrote about one study that went all the way back to 1999 and looked at what happened over the next 10 years to all of the top-performing funds that had received a five-star rating from Morningstar. What did the researchers discover? Of the 248 mutual stock funds with five-star ratings at the start of the period, just 4 still kept that rank after 10 years. The fancy term for this process is reversion to the mean, a polite way of saying that most high flyers will eventually fall, reverting back to mediocrity. Unfortunately, many people pick top-rated funds without realizing that they're falling into the trap of buying what's hot, usually right before it turns cold, David Swenson explains. Nobody wants to say, "I own a bunch of 1- and 2-star funds." They want to own 4-star funds and 5-star funds and brag about it at the office. But the 4- and 5-star funds are the ones that have performed well, not the ones that will perform well. If you systematically buy the ones that have performed well and sell the ones that have performed poorly, you're going to end up underperforming. Mutual fund companies are notorious for opening lots of funds in hopes that a few of them might outperform. They can then quietly close all the funds that did badly and heavily market the few that did well. After all, they can't sell shoddy past performance, no matter how glossy the brochure. Jack Bogle explains, "A firm will go out and start 5 incubation funds, and they will try to shoot the lights out with all 5 of them. And of course, they don't with 4 of them, but they do with 1. So they drop the other 4 and take public the one that did very well, with a great track record, and sell that track record." Bogle adds, "Statistically, you're bound to have a few outperformers if you create enough funds." Tony, if you pack 1,024 gorillas into a gymnasium and teach them each to flip a coin, one of them will flip heads 10 times in a row. Most would call that luck, But when that happens in the fund business, we call him a genius. Does all of this mean it's impossible to beat the market over long periods of time? Actually, no. It's extremely hard, but there are a few unicorns out there who have outperformed the market by a mile over several decades. These are superstars such as Warren Buffett, Ray Dalio, Carl Icahn, and Paul Tudor Jones, who not only are brilliantly clever but also have ideal temperaments, enabling them to remain calm and rational even when markets are imploding and most people are losing their minds. One reason why they win is that they base every investment decision on a deep understanding of probabilities, not on emotion or desire or luck. But most of these unicorns run enormous hedge funds that are closed to new investors. For example, Ray Dalio used to accept money from investors who had a net worth of at least $5 billion and who entrusted him with a minimum of $100 million. Nowadays, he won't accept any new investors, regardless of how many billions you've got hidden under your mattress. When I asked Ray how hard it is to beat the market over the long run, he didn't pull his punches. "You're not going to beat the market," he told me. "Competing in the markets is more difficult than winning in the Olympics. There are more people who are trying to do it and much bigger rewards if you succeed. Like competing in the Olympics, only an infinitesimal percentage succeed. But unlike winning in the Olympics, most people think they can do it. Before you try to beat the market, recognize that your likelihood of being successful is extremely small, and ask yourself if you spent the time to train and prepare to be one of the few who actually wins. You can't ignore it when one of the giants who has actually beaten the market over decades tells you that you shouldn't even bother trying, but should stick instead with index funds. Warren Buffett, who has outpaced the market by a huge margin, also advises regular people to invest in index funds so they can avoid the drain of excessive fees. To prove his point that almost all active managers underperform index funds over the long run, he made a $1 million bet in 2008 with a New York-based firm called Protégé Partners. He challenged Protégé to select five top hedge fund managers who could collectively beat the S&P 500 over a 10-year period. So what happened? After 8 years, Fortune reported that these hedge funds were up only 21.87% versus 65.67% for the S&P 500. The race isn't over yet, but as it stands, these active managers look like contestants in a three-legged race trying to catch Usain Bolt, the world's fastest man. Meanwhile, Buffett says he's left instructions that after his death, the money he leaves in trust for his wife should be invested in low-cost index funds. His explanation? "I believe the trust's long-term results from this policy will be superior to those attained by most investors, whether pension funds, institutions, or individuals, who employ high-fee managers." Even from his grave, Buffett is absolutely determined to avoid the corrosive effects of high fees. Brilliant guidance from the Oracle of Omaha himself. Do you remember when I told you earlier that knowledge is merely potential power? It's only when you take your knowledge and act on it that you possess true power. In this chapter, you've learned what an astounding impact fees can have on your financial future. But what will you do with that knowledge? How will you act on it and benefit from it? Imagine for a moment that you stop buying actively managed funds that charge exorbitant fees. Instead, from now on, you invest only in low-cost index funds. What's the result? At the very least, I would estimate that you can cut your fund expenses by 1% a year. But as you know, that's not the only benefit of switching to index funds. Hypothetically, let's imagine that your index funds outperform those actively managed funds by 1% annually. In total, you've just added 2% a year to your returns. This alone can give you 20 years of extra retirement income. Now do you see how much power you possess to take charge of your financial future? Take that power and use it to dramatically drive down your costs. This will help you immeasurably to become unshakable. Meanwhile, let's take a breath. Then let's step into another area where you can save yourself a fortune, your 401k. Keep listening. We're about to embark on a mission to rescue your retirement account. Chapter 4. Rescuing Our Retirement Plans, What Your 401k Provider Doesn't Want You to Know. The 401k plan was a beautiful invention. Created in 1984, it gave regular people like you and me a chance to build wealth by making tax-deductible contributions to a retirement account directly from our paychecks. What a great concept. You and I were given this opportunity to own a piece of the American dream, to invest in our own futures, to take full responsibility for achieving our own financial freedom. Now, nearly 90 million Americans participate in 401k plans. To put that in perspective, only 75 million Americans own a home. With more than $6 trillion currently invested in 401ks, this is the single most important vehicle for the financial security of the U.S. population. But you know what happened? Somewhere along the line, the dream got derailed. With trillions of dollars up for grabs, financial firms dreamed up countless ways to dip all of their fingers, thumbs, and toes into the pie. This is the uglier side of our nation's gift for innovation. And it places us under enormous pressure to learn how to protect ourselves from these money grubbers. You might not believe this, but for almost three decades, the companies providing 401k plans were not even required by law to disclose how much they were charging their customers. Only in 2012 did the government finally force these firms to make detailed disclosures of how much they were extracting from your savings. In what other industry would customers tolerate this trust-me style of doing business? Can you imagine a clothing store with no price tags? Can you imagine booking a vacation and leaving it up to the airline and the hotel to decide how much to drain from your bank account without informing you? Needless to say, the financial firms resisted the temptation to take advantage of this lack of disclosure, since they understood that handling our retirement money is a sacred trust. Just kidding. Of course they took advantage. Now that the law has changed, would you guess that the problem has been fixed? Hardly. The whole 401k system is still a black box. Today, financial firms provide disclosure documents that are often 30 to 50 pages long and filled with impenetrable language. Surprise, surprise, not that many people devote their weekends to reading these ultra-complicated documents. Instead of digging through the fine print, most plan participants simply trust that their employers are looking out for them, and most employers are trusting the broker who sold them the plan over a round of golf. Remember, 71% of people enrolled in 401ks think there are no fees, and 92% admit that they have no clue what they are. But the truth is, the vast majority of plans are characterized by huge broker commissions, expensive, actively managed funds, and layer after layer of additional and often hidden charges. Robert Hilton Smith, a senior policy analyst at a think tank called Demos, took the trouble to study and decipher the prospectuses of 20 funds in his 401k plan. He hacked his way through the forest of bewildering legalese and confusing acronyms, and then wrote a report entitled The Retirement Savings Drain, The Hidden and Excessive Costs of 401ks. What did he find? Customers like him, and you and me, were hit with 17 different fees and additional costs. Just to be clear, we're not referring here to the absurdly high fees that you're being charged by the mutual funds in your 401k plan. It's not enough for you to pay for all those actively managed funds, the ones that Forbes says could be costing you 3.17% a year. No, these are the additional fees that you're also being charged by the plan provider that's administering your 401k. These providers are typically insurance or payroll companies, but you might want to think of them as another set of exceptionally well-paid toll collectors. You've got to hand it to these providers. They're truly ingenious when it comes to dreaming up different ways to siphon off the money in your 401k. Here's a short sample of the many categories of fees they've invented. Investment expenses, communication expenses, bookkeeping expenses, administrative expenses, trustee expenses, legal expenses, transactional expenses, and stewardship expenses. Why not just add a category called expense expenses? I'm always amazed by what you can find buried in the fine print of providers' disclosure documents, the vague terminology that obscures exactly what's being done to you. For example, you'll often see intentionally meaningless terms such as net asset charge, asset management charge, contract asset charge, AMC charge, or CAC charge. One provider, a leading insurance company, was so brazen as to add a line item called required revenue. Required by who? What for? To pay for the CEO to buy a yacht? How much does all of this cost you? Hilton Smith calculated the impact of these additional 401k fees on an average worker who earns about $30,000 a year and saves 5% of his or her annual income. Over a lifetime, this worker would lose $154,794 in fees. That's more than 5 years of income. A worker who earns about $90,000 a year would lose $277,000 in 401k fees. You know as well as I do how hard it is for most people to save money for retirement. It requires real sacrifices, but excessive expenses can easily destroy the benefits of all that effort. Some plans take the excessive fees to a whole other level. Certain providers, not content with their typical take, charge a front-end sales load on all initial deposits. One of the worst we have seen takes a whopping 5.75% of every single dollar you sock away. It's like a tithe to the corporate gods running these companies. Add that to the 2% in annual fees they charge, and you're down 7.75% before you're out of the gate. Sadly, teachers, nurses, and nonprofit employees are most vulnerable to this huge skimming operation. This is because their 403b plans, their equivalent of a 401k, aren't covered under the same Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974 laws that are, at least in theory, designed to protect employees. It makes me sick to think that those who sacrifice the most to make our society better are being screwed by brokers who somehow manage to sleep at night, probably on 2,000 thread count sheets. In a New York Times article titled, "Think Your Retirement Plan is Bad? Talk to a Teacher," reporter Tara Siegel Bernard does a brilliant job exposing how these poor folks are mugged. In one of the most ghastly scenarios imaginable, the teachers were each charged a fee of at least 2% of their savings to manage the money, in addition to sales charges of up to 6% each time they made a deposit. Moreover, the calculations didn't include the expenses of the dozens of mutual funds they were invested in, some of which exceeded 1%. That's 9% in first-year expenses alone. That's not a hole in your boat. That's the whole back of the boat ripped off and dragging in the water. This is why it's so important to be aware of how the financial industry stacks the odds against you. Knowledge is your first defense. After all, how can you protect yourself from a threat to your financial well-being unless you know that this threat exists? One person who shares my outrage about 401k expenses is the comedian John Oliver, who investigated the subject for his HBO show Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. When the members of his research team dissected their own 401k plan, they discovered that their provider's fees amounted to 1.69% a year, excluding the exorbitant fees they were also being charged to invest in the actively managed funds in their plan. Oliver explains how seemingly tiny fees can mount up until you've lost almost two-thirds of what you would have had. He warns, "Think of fees like termites. They're tiny, they're barely noticeable, and they can eat away your effing future." Heads, I win. Tails, you lose. What makes all of this so upsetting is that a 401k should be, and can be, a powerful tool for building wealth, if it's used correctly. Instead, the vast majority of plans are riddled with opaque fee arrangements and conflicts of interest. In 2015, the Obama administration announced that hidden fees and backdoor payments were costing Americans more than $17 billion per year. And Secretary of Labor Thomas E. Perez has said, "The corrosive power of fine print and buried fees can eat away like a chronic illness at a person's savings." In early 2016, Congress passed new laws designed to force 401k providers to act in their clients' best interests. Sadly, by the time lobbyists had done their worst, these regulations had lost their teeth. For example, 401k brokers can still charge commissions, sell you their own overpriced name brand funds, and whack you with front-loaded sales charges. Business as usual. If you ask me, one of the worst abuses is that nearly all of the big-name providers routinely accept payments from the mutual funds they offer in 401k plans. This legal but grubby arrangement is called revenue sharing or pay-to-play. It's the equivalent of buying shelf space in a store to ensure that it will stock a crappy product that shoppers really ought to avoid. What's the result? Many of the funds you get to choose from in your 401k plan are on the list only because the fund company paid the provider to include them. These funds tend to be actively managed, so they're expensive, and they're rarely the best performers. In some cases, they even charge a front-end load, a fee that often amounts to 3% of your assets, just to buy the fund in the first place. So why not just pick low-cost index funds when you're investing in your 401k plan? A great question. The trouble is, most providers make index funds available only if the plan has a high level of assets. Why? Because index funds aren't sufficiently lucrative for the provider. So they prefer to exclude them from the menu if they can get away with it. If you work for a smaller company, chances are that you'll be forced to invest in funds with higher fees. In fact, 93% of 401k plans have less than $5 million in total plan assets. These are small and mid-sized companies that don't have the buying power to demand better investment options for their employees, yet it's entirely unfair to penalize people for working at smaller companies. Some 401k providers do offer index funds to smaller plans, but they typically charge a significant markup. One major insurance company is offering an S&P 500 index fund for 1.68% annually, when the actual cost is just 0.05%. That's a 3,260% markup. Think of it this way. Your friend buys a Honda Accord for the regular retail price of $22,000, but you're forced to pay a 3,260% markup. Your cost for the exact same car? $717,200. Welcome to the world of high finance. Another well-known insurance company charges a 3% sales load to buy a Vanguard index fund and then charges 0.65% a year in fees for the fund, a steal at a mere 1,300% markup. This is the white-collar equivalent of ruthless mobsters coming round to your small business and hitting you up for protection money. The only justification is that you have money and they want it. Meanwhile, some providers will allow you to open your own self-directed 401k account if you want access to low-cost index funds or want to manage your own investments. Sounds like a good option, right? One friend of mine thought so. He opened a self-directed account, bought some index funds, and congratulated himself on bypassing all the ridiculously expensive funds in his plan. Then he found out that the provider was charging him an additional 1.9% a year for the privilege of using a self-directed account. In other words, heads you lose, tails I win. These tricks of the trade are at last coming back to haunt many 401k providers. As I write this, at least 10 major providers have been sued by their employees for charging excessive fees in their own 401k plans. One of the biggest 401k providers settled two class action lawsuits for $12 million after accusations by its own employees that its 401k fees were too high. Imagine going to a restaurant and discovering that the waiters and kitchen staff refuse to eat the chef's food. When the insiders don't like what their company is selling, should you and I just smile politely and accept that it's good enough for the likes of us? One reason why I feel so passionate about this is that I've experienced firsthand how easy it is to get exploited by unscrupulous 401k providers. When I began to see these widespread abuses at companies across America, I called the head of human resources at one of my companies to learn more about the plan we were providing for our employees. I think of them as family, and I wanted to make sure we were treating them with all the care they deserve. To my horror, I discovered that our name brand 401k plan, administered by a major insurance company, was loaded with expensive mutual funds, excessive administrative expenses, and fat commissions that we paid to the broker who sold us the plan. It turned out that the total expenses in our 401k plan amounted to 2.17% a year. Over time, these fees would erode much of the money that our employees were saving scrupulously for their future. I was beside myself. So I began to look around for a solution. After much investigation, I was introduced by a friend to Tom Zegainer, CEO of a company called America's Best 401k, ABK. As you'd imagine, I was more than a little skeptical. Why should I believe that his firm would live up to its less than modest name? But it didn't take long to realize that he's a truth teller who's determined to challenge his industry's unseemly practices. As Tom told me, the 401k business is the largest dark pool of assets where nobody really knows how or whose hands are getting greased. By contrast, ABK is entirely transparent. For example, he has no interest in the sordid pay-to-play game. Instead of accepting kickbacks from mutual fund companies that want him to sell their overpriced funds, he offers only inexpensive index funds from firms such as Vanguard and Dimensional Fund Advisors. Tom's company charges one fee with no markups or hidden costs. It's a fully bundled solution that eliminates brokers, commissions, and high-paid middlemen. I'm delighted to tell you that I quickly and easily moved my company's old plan into a new plan administered by America's Best 401k. The total cost for our new 401k plan, including investment expenses, investment management services, and record-keeping fees, add up to a grand total of just 0.65% a year. That's a savings of about 70% in our annual expenses. Over the years, this should put as much as $5 million back into the pockets of my employees. And Tom charges nothing for companies to make the switch. I was so impressed that I referred many other friends to ABK. To my delight, they were all thrilled, and no wonder. Tom's firm saves his average client more than 57% in fees. I got excited and decided to partner with Tom on his mission to rescue the retirement plans of millions of people. It's time to break the ruthless chokehold this industry has on our family's financial futures. Whether you are a business owner or an employee, you can see how your company's 401k plan stacks up by using his free online fee checker tool at www.showmethefees.com. It will analyze your plan and calculate within seconds how much you're being charged in fees. Business owners can go one step further and provide a copy of their fee disclosure for a more detailed look under the hood. Most important, this quick process can also show you how much you can save over time by switching to a better plan. I won't be surprised if you save yourself hundreds of thousands of dollars over the years. I was chatting about this with my dentist and friend, Dr. Craig Spodak. He has more than 40 employees, and he wanted to make sure they weren't being ripped off. I don't want to name specific names here because these problems are systemic, not just limited to a handful of companies. But when Craig told me the name of the infamous company that provided his 401k plan, I couldn't help but cringe. My diagnosis was immediate. His dentistry practice would need to undergo an urgent extraction. Otherwise, the pain would only get worse. I put Craig in contact with my partners at America's Best 401k. In a matter of minutes, he emailed them his plan's fee disclosure form, and they drilled down to expose his fees. He was shocked by the results. It turned out that his plan contained a long list of overpriced mutual funds and an additional layer of bloated contract asset charges. The total costs he and his employees paid for this terrible plan were north of 2.5% a year. Suddenly, Craig understood why his broker used to bring him donuts as a gift and why the man was always grinning from ear to ear. You won't be surprised to hear that Craig fired his broker, dumped his provider, and entrusted his plan instead to America's Best 401k. Employers need to wake up, just as Craig and I did, so they can ensure that their employees aren't being exploited. Otherwise, there could be a high price to pay, not just for the employees, but also for the employer. If you're an employee, after you use the fee checker, you can forward the report to your company's owner or to senior management. Once they know the truth about what's going on, they may well want to improve your 401k plan. After all, their financial future is also at stake. Business owners, beware. Take 3 minutes to discover how you can eliminate legal liabilities and protect yourself and your company from new Department of Labor fines. If you own or run a company that offers a 401k plan, you're officially regarded as the plan's sponsor, whether you know it or not. That means it's your legal obligation to act as the fiduciary to your plan and to your employees, which means that you have to operate in their best interests. If you trip up, you could easily find yourself with a major liability that could damage your business and even your own finances. It's a bit like owning a house that's structurally unsound. You might be fine for years until you're not. So ignore this at your peril. What do you have to do? First, you need to demonstrate to the Department of Labor, DOL, that you're taking the necessary steps to fulfill your role as the plan's sponsor. This includes periodically benchmarking your plan against other plans to ensure that the fees being charged in your plan are reasonable. Most business owners I talk to have no idea about this obligation. This potentially exposes them to the mighty wrath of the DOL. In 2014, the department determined that 75% of the plans it examined were illegal. The average fine, $600,000. And that's just the beginning. You're also exposed to the risk that your own employees could sue you personally. In 2015, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a major ruling against Edison International, the power giant. This decision should make it easier for 401k plan participants to sue their employers for choosing investments with excessive fees. Small businesses are particularly vulnerable not just because it's hard for them to afford hefty fines, but also because they tend to have small 401k plans, which typically charge the highest fees. One practical step that could save you a fortune is to contact my partners at America's Best 401k and ask them to provide you with a free benchmark for your plan. All it takes is a few minutes to furnish them with the fee disclosure statement for your plan. The fact that you've obtained this benchmark demonstrates to the DOL that you've taken your legal responsibility seriously. Even better, many companies discover that they can easily cut their plan's fees in half, or more. If so, that will endow you and your employees with a huge windfall for many years to come. ShowMeTheFees.com. Where are we headed next? Before we turn our focus to your investment playbook, we've got one more invaluable lesson to cover. How to find sophisticated, conflict-free financial advice that will turbocharge your journey to financial success. You'll learn how to avoid all those salespeople in disguise who get rich by dishing out so-called advice that benefits them, not you. As you'll see, choosing the right advisor can mean the difference between poverty and wealth, between insecurity and freedom. The choice is yours. So let's find out. Who can you really trust? Chapter 5. Who can you really trust? Pulling back the curtain on the tricks of the trade. It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it. Upton Sinclair. When I ask people how they're doing, the most common answer I get is, busy. We're all running faster than ever these days. So it's no surprise that more and more of us are hiring financial advisors to help us navigate the complicated journey to financial freedom. From 2010 to 2015, the percentage of the U.S. population using financial advisors doubled. In fact, more than 40% of Americans now use an advisor. And the more money you have, the more likely you are to seek out advice. 81% of people with more than $5 million have an advisor. But how do you find an advisor you trust, and who deserves your trust? It's astonishing how many people don't trust the person giving them financial advice. A 2016 survey by the Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards found that 60% of respondents believe that financial advisors act in their company's best interests rather than the consumer's best interests. That figure had soared from 25% since 2010. To put that in perspective, Congress currently has a dismal 20% approval rating, but just 10% of Americans surveyed trust financial institutions. It's hard to think of any other industry where customers feel so suspicious, except perhaps the used car business. What accounts for this epidemic of distrust? Well, it's not easy to place your full faith and confidence in an industry that's constantly in the news for yet another scandal. In fact, 10 of the world's largest financial firms have had to fork out $179.5 billion in legal settlements just in the 7 years from 2009 through 2015. Bank of America had 34 settlements and paid $77.09 billion. J.P. Morgan Chase had 26 settlements and paid $40.12 billion. Citigroup had 18 settlements and paid $18.39 billion. Wells Fargo, 10 settlements at $10.24 billion. BNP Paribas, 1 settlement at $8.9 billion. UBS, 8 settlements at $6.54 billion. Deutsche Bank, 4 settlements at $5.53 billion. Morgan Stanley, 7 settlements at $4.78 billion. Barclays, also 7 settlements at $4.23 billion. And finally, Credit Suisse, 4 settlements at $3.74 billion. Some of the stories behind these settlements are so outrageous that they make you shake your head and wonder. Here's a sample of four typical newspaper headlines just from the last few months. Bank of America to pay $415 million to settle SEC probe. The Wall Street Journal reports that the bank's Merrill Lynch brokerage unit misused customer cash and securities to generate profits for itself, putting at risk up to $58 billion in client assets. Citigroup fined in rate-rigging inquiry but avoids criminal charges. The New York Times reports that the bank was fined $425 million for manipulating benchmark interest rates from 2007 to 2012. Citigroup's motive? To benefit its own trading positions at the expense of its trading partners and clients. Ex-Barclays employees guilty of LIBOR rigging. USA Today reports that three former Barclays employees conspired to manipulate a global financial benchmark used to set rates on trillions of dollars of mortgages and other loans. Did you get that? That's trillions with a T. Wells Fargo fined $185 million for fraudulently opening accounts. The New York Times reports that employees of the bank opened roughly 1.5 million bank accounts and applied for 565,000 credit cards without customer consent. The bank fired at least 5,300 employees involved in this scandal. How can you place your financial future in the hands of people who work in an industry with this demonstrated record of putting its own interests above those of its clients? How can you expect them not to deceive, exploit, and abuse you? After all, these companies aren't fringe operators with fly-by-night reputations. These are, or were, some of the most respected and most blue-chip behemoths in this business. For example, Wells Fargo had long been celebrated as one of the best-run banks in the world, yet its CEO was forced to resign in shame over his firm's opening of fake bank accounts, forfeiting $41 million in stock options that he'd received as a reward for his performance. Now, let me be absolutely clear. I'm not criticizing any individuals who work in this field or for these specific firms. I'd be surprised if the CEO of Wells Fargo truly knew about this widespread wrongdoing within his massive company, which has more than 250,000 employees. Policing companies this enormous has become an almost impossible challenge for some. I have lots of friends and clients in the financial industry, so I'm speaking with firsthand knowledge when I tell you that they and the vast majority of their colleagues are people of real integrity. They have good hearts and good intentions. The trouble is, they work in a system that's beyond their control, a system that has tremendously powerful financial incentives to focus on maximizing profits above all else. This is a system that richly rewards employees who put their employer's interests first, their own interests second, and their clients' interests a distant third. And for folks like you and me, that's a recipe for disaster. Unless we take the precaution of learning how the system works against us and how to counter it. You can trust me to take advantage of you. Before we go any further, it's worth explaining where financial advisors fit within this profit-hungry system and what exactly they do. They operate in a realm where nothing is quite what it seems to be, so it's fitting that they go by many different names, which often seem downright misleading. According to the Wall Street Journal, there are more than 200 different designations for financial advisors, including financial consultants, wealth managers, financial advisors, investment consultants, wealth advisors, and, in case that doesn't sound exclusive enough, private wealth advisors. These are all just different ways of saying, I'm respectable, I'm professional, of course you can trust me. Regardless of the title, what you really need to know is that 90% of the roughly 310,000 financial advisors in America are actually just brokers. In other words, they're paid to sell financial products to customers like you and me in return for a fee. Why does this matter? Because brokers have a vested interest in hawking expensive products, which might include actively managed mutual funds, whole life insurance policies, variable annuities, and wrap accounts. These products typically pay them a one-time sales commission, or even better for them, ongoing annual fees. A broker at a major firm might be required to produce at least $500,000 a year in sales, so it doesn't matter how fancy the title sounds, these are salespeople under intense pressure to generate revenues. If calling themselves a financial consultant or a private wealth advisor helps them reach their aggressive sales targets, so be it. If calling themselves a wizard, a pixie, or an elf helped more, that'd be just fine, too. Does this mean they're dishonest? Not at all. but it does mean they're working for the house, and remember, the house always wins. There's a good chance your broker is a sincere person with high integrity, but he's selling what he's been trained to sell, and you should always assume that whatever he's selling will benefit the house first. Sophisticated customers know this is standard operating procedure. One survey found that 42% of ultra-wealthy clients think their advisor is more concerned with selling products than with helping them. Warren Buffett jokes that you never want to ask a barber whether you need a haircut. Well, brokers are the barbers of the financial world. They're trained and incentivized to sell, regardless of whether you need what they're selling. That's not a criticism, it's just a fact. I also want to make it clear that I'm not out to criticize or demonize the financial firms that employ these brokers. Have these companies done their fair share of stupid, unethical, and illegal things? You bet. But they're not evil or malicious. They never set out to sabotage the global economic system. These companies simply do what they're incentivized to do, which is to meet shareholders' needs. And what do shareholders need? Bigger profits. And what creates bigger profits? More fees. If there's a legally gray area that these companies can exploit to generate those additional fees, they're likely to do it because that's what they're incentivized to do. You might expect all those enormous legal settlements to act as a deterrent, encouraging these companies to improve their behavior. But these penalties are paltry for such colossal businesses. Bank of America had to shell out $415 million in fines for misusing its customers' assets. Big deal. In one three-month period in 2015, the bank earned a profit of $5.3 billion. That's in just 12 weeks. For companies this rich, those pesky fines are just a routine cost of doing business, the equivalent of you or me getting a parking ticket. Instead of changing their ways, these companies focus much of their effort on burnishing their brands through slick ad campaigns featuring dreamy images of sailboats and romantic walks on the beach. Why am I telling you this? Because we're conditioned to trust brands. We need to break free from this conditioning and look with more critical eyes at the reality, not the illusion. Otherwise, how can we safeguard ourselves against this powerful system that's fueled by self-interest? It makes me angry and sad that the financial system is so broken. But anger and sadness won't protect you from getting ripped off. What will protect you is knowing how the system can work against you. If you don't understand the incentives of your advisor, you're liable to discover that you've done wonders for his financial future while potentially wrecking your own. In this chapter, you will learn how to navigate the minefield. You'll learn to distinguish between three different types of advisors so you can sidestep the salespeople and choose a fiduciary who is required by law to act in your best interests. We'll also give you the criteria to judge whether a particular advisor is right or wrong for you based on fact, not on how likable he or she is. After all, it's easy to be persuaded by people you like, especially when they are sincere. Remember, people can be sincere and sincerely wrong. Maybe you're wondering if you need an advisor at all. If you decide to manage your own finances, this audiobook and Money Master the Game will set you on the right track so you can achieve your financial goals. But in my experience, the best financial advisors can add extraordinary value by helping you with everything from investing to taxes to insurance. They provide holistic advice that's truly invaluable. For me, getting first-rate advice has been a game-changer, saving me a tremendous amount of money and time. I'm a capable guy, and I pride myself on understanding the most important principles in anything I'm a part of, but I'm not about to do brain surgery on myself. Skeptical about the value of the right advisor? While the wrong advisors can be detrimental to your financial health, the right ones can be worth their value in gold. A recent Vanguard study explored exactly how much monetary value an advisor can bring to your investments. Lowering your expense ratios, 45 basis points, 0.45% back in your pocket. Rebalancing portfolio, 35 basis points, 0.35% of increased performance. Asset allocation, 75 basis points, 0.75% of increased performance. Withdrawing the right investments in retirement, 70 basis points, 0.7% in savings. Behavioral coaching, 150 basis points, 1.5% for serving as your practical psychologist. The grand total, 3.75% of added value. That's more than three times what a sophisticated advisor would charge. And heck, that doesn't include reducing taxes and more. A losing bet. One of these things is not like the others. Big Bird. Did you ever have that unsettling suspicion that someone wasn't telling you the whole truth, but you couldn't quite put your finger on why you didn't trust the person or how exactly he or she might be lying to you? It's a familiar feeling when you're searching for financial advice. How can you tell if the person offering you help is the real deal? And how can you even know where to start when so many different people with so many different titles are offering you potential solutions? In the interest of cutting through the confusion, I'm going to make this as simple and straightforward as possible. In reality, all financial advisors fall into just one of three categories. What you really need to know is whether your advisor is a broker, an independent advisor, or a duly registered advisor. Now, let's break this down in more detail so you know exactly what you're dealing with. Brokers. As I mentioned earlier, about 90% of all financial advisors in America are brokers, regardless of the title on their business card. They're paid a fee or commission for selling products. Many of them work for enormous Wall Street banks, brokerage houses, and insurance companies, the kind that splash their names on sports arenas. How do you know if the product a broker recommends is the best one for you? Let me clear it up. Brokers don't have to recommend the best product for you. What? Yes, you heard me right. All they're obliged to do is follow what's known as the suitability standard. That means they must simply believe that any recommendations they make are suitable for their clients. Suitability is an extremely low bar to clear. Do you dream of marrying a suitable person or your soulmate? But for a broker, suitable is good enough. The problem is, brokers and their employers earn more by recommending certain products. For example, an actively managed fund with high expenses will be far more lucrative for the broker and the brokerage house than a low-cost index fund, which will be far more lucrative for you and your family. Does it sound to you like there's a serious conflict of interest here? Damn right. How is it that profits over people has become the accepted standard? To put this in context, the United Kingdom has a fiduciary standard, which means that all financial advisors are required by law to act in their clients' best interests. Australia also has a fiduciary standard. So why aren't American professionals obliged to act as fiduciaries? Actually, they are, except for financial professionals. Doctors, lawyers, and certified public accountants in the United States are legally required to act in the best interests of the people they help. Yet financial advisors get a free pass. There have been many attempts to enact laws requiring advisors to serve their clients' best interests, but the financial industry has lobbied hard to block these laws. Why? Frankly, advisors and their employers would earn way less money if they could no longer stack the deck in their favor. Imagine their horror if they could no longer hawk their own overpriced products or collect substantial commissions and secret kickbacks, such as revenue-sharing deals from other companies. One piece of moderately good news is that the Department of Labor recently passed a new regulation requiring advisors to put their clients' interests first in one specific situation, when handling 401k and IRA retirement accounts. But even then, there are still major loopholes. If you're working with a broker, at some point you'll probably receive a phone call or a letter asking you to sign a Best Interest Contract Exemption, or BICE. The broker may tell you, "The government passed a ridiculous law that limits your choices. If you sign this form, I can continue offering you a full menu of options." Don't fall for it. This is code for "please sign this form so I can keep selling you my firm's most profitable products and collecting big commissions." In addition, with the recent election of Donald Trump, his advisors are all talking about rolling back the new regulations before they're even implemented. So by the time you listen to this, those protections may not even exist. Here's the bottom line. This system is so riddled with conflicts of interest that it puts you in a highly vulnerable position. But what if you're already working with a broker you like and trust? I'm not suggesting that it's impossible to find talented, trustworthy brokers who do a fine job, but playing a game where the odds are so heavily stacked against you isn't an intelligent move. The most successful investors and even professional gamblers always try to make sure the odds are on their side. How can the odds be on your side if your broker has a hidden financial agenda? David Swensen, Yale's investment guru, warned me that no matter how much you may like your broker is not your friend. Registered Investment Advisors. Of 308,937 financial advisors in the United States, only 31,000, approximately 10%, are registered investment advisors, also known as RIAs or independent advisors. Like doctors and lawyers, they have a fiduciary duty and a legal obligation to act in their clients' best interests at all times. It's simple common sense, right? But in the strange twilight zone of the financial industry, it's anything but common. To give you a sense of how strong the laws are, if your RIA tells you to buy Apple in the morning and he buys it for himself at a cheaper price in the afternoon, he has to give you his stock. Try asking your broker to do that. In addition, before doing business with you, your RIA must disclose any conflicts of interest and explain upfront how he or she is paid. No hocus-pocus, nothing hidden, no tricks, no lies, all cards on the table. Now, why would you ever choose a financial advisor who doesn't have to act in your best interests over one who does? You wouldn't. Yet most people do just that. One reason is that they simply don't know any better. The fact that you're listening to this book puts you in an elite group, one that understands the fundamental rules of this high-stakes game. Another reason why so many people use brokers is that RIAs are like rare birds. There's only a 1 in 10 chance of spotting one. How come there are so few RIAs if this is such a superior model? The most obvious reason is that brokers tend to earn a lot more money. All those fat fees from selling financial products can be extremely lucrative. By contrast, RIAs don't accept sales commissions. Instead, they typically charge a flat fee for financial advice or a percentage of their clients' assets under management. It's a cleaner model that removes awkward conflicts of interest. Duly registered advisors. When I first learned about the difference between brokers and RIAs, everything seemed so clear and simple to me. You undoubtedly want someone who will act in your best interest, right? So it seemed obvious to insist on working with an independent advisor who's legally obliged to act as a fiduciary. I thought of fiduciaries as the gold standard, but then I discovered that this subject is murkier than I'd realized. Here's the problem. The vast majority of independent advisors are registered as both fiduciaries and brokers. WTF. In fact, as many as 26,000 out of 31,000 RIAs operate in this gray area where they have one foot in both camps. That's right, only 5,000 of the nation's 310,000 financial advisors are pure fiduciaries. That's a measly 1.6%. Now you know why it's so hard to get unconflicted and transparent advice. When I wrote Money, Master the Game, I became a champion of fiduciaries, only to discover this inconvenient truth about dual registration, first brought to me by Peter Malouk. It infuriated me to learn how these dual registrants actually operate. One moment they play the part of an independent advisor, reassuring you that they abide by the fiduciary standard and can provide you with conflict-free advice for a fee. A second later, they switch hats and act as a broker, earning commissions by selling you products. When they're playing this broker role, they no longer have to abide by the fiduciary standard. In other words, they're sometimes obliged to serve your best interests and sometimes not. How warped is that? How are you supposed to tell which hat they're wearing at any given moment? Believe me, it's not easy. I've had the experience of asking an advisor if he was a fiduciary and having him look me in the eye and assure me that he was. He talked to me about how untrustworthy brokers are and how much better it is to be a fiduciary. He told me that our interests were perfectly aligned. Then I discovered that he was also acting as a broker since he was duly registered, and it turned out that he made all sorts of side deals that earned him loads of commissions. Here was a person I thought I could recommend as a fiduciary, and he lied to my face. Still, he hadn't broken any laws. I was furious when I realized how easy it is to get misled. Ironically, most dual registrants were originally brokers who gave up corner offices and sizable incomes to make the leap to becoming RIAs. They wanted complete independence to be able to provide their clients with the full range of investment options, not just the carefully crafted menu of products that their previous employer imposed. They wanted to wear the white hat and not the black hat, and so they took the risk and made the jump to RIA, only to discover the sad truth that it's financially really hard to be a pure fiduciary. These duly registered advisors have good intentions, but they get caught between two worlds, trying to be honorable while also having to make compromises. It's not the fault of the individuals. It's that the industry is structured so that selling products is the easiest way to make good money and pay the bills. A little respect. I'm about to give you all of my money, and all I'm asking in return, honey, is for a little respect. Aretha Franklin, Respect. By now, you've learned some key facts that will save you a lot of suffering and sorrow. You know that 90% of financial advisors are really just brokers in disguise. You know that they don't have to put your interests first. You know that they're under tremendous pressure to peddle overpriced products. You know that the odds of finding good advice improve dramatically if you steer clear of all brokers, however unfair that seems, and work instead with independent advisors who have a fiduciary duty to put your interests first. You know that all fiduciaries are not created equal, since some can suddenly mutate into brokers. So now you know what to avoid. We've eliminated about 98% of all the advisors out there on the grounds that they're either brokers or duly registered hybrids. What are you left with? Thousands of independent advisors who are legally obligated to act as fiduciaries. It shouldn't be too difficult to find one who meets your needs. But you still have to tread carefully. Why? Because conflicts of interest can arise even when you're working with an independent advisor, typically involving clever but legal schemes to make additional money off you while you're looking the other way. Here are three tricks of the trade you should watch out for. The poison of proprietary funds. Brokers routinely sell proprietary funds created by their own firm. It's a not-so-subtle strategy for keeping fees in the family, a common money-making scheme that depends on clients being naive enough not to ask whether another firm might offer better or cheaper funds. It's just the kind of self-serving behavior that should make you wary of working with brokers. But I'm sorry to tell you that many independent advisors have also figured out furtive ways to use this ruse. Here's how it typically works. The advisory firm has two arms, one of which is a registered investment advisor that offers independent advice. So far, so good. But the firm's second arm is a sister company that owns and operates a bunch of proprietary mutual funds. The RIA pretends to offer impartial advice, but actually recommends that you buy the overpriced funds sold by its sister company. As Saturday Night Live's church lady would say, how convenient. The great thing is that all the profits stay in-house, which is better for everyone. Oh, except for the client. The poor client, we might as well call him the Mark, pays the advisor twice for independent advice on which investments to own and for the parent company's own mediocre funds. Most clients aren't even aware that they're buying funds owned by the same firm. That's because the fund arm and the advisory arm typically operate under different brand names. It's like watching a master pickpocket at work. The trickery is so sly and cynical that you almost have to admire it. An additional fee for doing nothing. Here's another scheme that's becoming increasingly common. You pay an advisor a fee to manage your money, let's say 1% of your assets. The advisor then recommends a model portfolio, he may even give it a fancy name like the XYZ portfolio series, which has its own additional fee, let's say 0.25% of your assets. This fee is over and above the cost of the underlying investments in your portfolio. But nothing additional is being done for you. The model portfolio consists of various investments the advisor has assembled, which is what you paid him to do in the first place. It's like buying $100 worth of groceries and getting slapped with a $25 fee for the right to carry them out of the store in a paper bag. If an advisor charges a money management fee for selecting investments, that should be it. End of story. Why should they be able to add another fee for pooling those investments together? I'll tell you why. Because they can. Because you might not notice. I can't accept a commission, so let's just call it a consulting fee. Some independent advisors make private deals with investment firms that enable the advisor to earn commissions without you knowing it. Here's how it works. Your advisor recommends the funds of a specific mutual fund company. The advisor can't do anything so tawdry as receiving a backdoor commission from the fund company in return for recommending its products. This presents a terrible conundrum for the advisor. What to do? Easy. Call this payoff something else. So the ingenious advisor approaches the fund company and asks instead for a consulting fee. The fund company gladly pays this fee and everyone lives happily ever after, except for you, the client, who just got duped into thinking that you were actually getting independent advice.